From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, are Scott Walker's foreign policy credentials burnished any further by his recent trip overseas? Later, even after 2 years of the Affordable Care Act, thought leaders in healthcare say there is still plenty of uncertainty.
I've been in healthcare now for 35 years, predominantly on the provider side. And the one constant we talk about all the time in healthcare is change.
The band Scythian plays what it calls immigrant rock, and one of its members says their concerts are a bit different than their albums.
It's kind of like just two different styles of art. Like, when you get the album, this is our music, this is our art. And then when you come to the live show, it's like that music pumped up with like 10 cans of Red Bull.
And the latest in our series on children and gun violence in Milwaukee. Lake Effect is next. First, the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. People around the country are reacting to the news over the weekend that a radical Islamist movement from Somalia was calling for terrorist attacks at shopping malls in the U.S. and Canada. That came at a time in which there is increased concern about the rise of the self-proclaimed Islamic State movement against people and interests from countries ranging from the United States to Japan to Egypt. And that's where we start this morning with our foreign policy contributor, Art Sear. He is a professor of political economy and world business at Carthage College in Kenosha. Good morning, Art. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mitch. It's always nice. Thank you for the warm welcome. And I'm also glad the heat is working here in the studio. It's always good to be back. Thank you.
Well, it has really been a disturbing time in a lot of the foreign policy realm in recent days. Let's start with Islamic State here. How much of the international response is made more complicated by maybe a general lack of understanding about what Islamic State's, so-called Islamic State's, endgame is here?
I'm not sure the Islamic State has a rational endgame. In fact, I'm pretty sure they do not. It's a very fanatical movement. It seems like a self-destructive, suicidal movement. Lest we seem too or feel too superior in our attitudes, it's reminiscent of the most extreme fanaticisms of the 20th century that took hold in some industrialized nations, most importantly Germany and Japan.
Well, and so, I mean, is part of the problem that we start with diplomacy or political efforts?
Very good question. At the moment, I don't see much opening for diplomacy with a movement that is this fanatical and this extreme. It is also, contrary to the headlines and much media commentary, not all that large a movement in cold, analytical terms. It does not represent the kind of enormous, virulent, extreme nationalism that the dictatorships of the 20th century represented. That's fortunate because they're not given to compromise. At some point, if they endure and if reality starts to intervene in their worldview, there might be room for diplomacy. But at the moment, there isn't. And our leaders and those of Europe are quite right to underscore that point.
If nothing else, the Islamic State movement has done a fine job, it seems, of uniting the rest of the world against it.
Yeah, that's an extremely important point. We have alliances with Jordan and Egypt, as does Israel. It's important to keep in mind, and those alliances have held, but they're complicated relationships and very challenging for us because ISIS is so extreme. It has strengthened the alliance, quite right.
Well, and so how do you think the debate about what the United States' response to ISIS ought to be, how should that debate play out?
I think the U.S. should be as supportive as possible. I don't think we should keep reiterating that we are not going to be sending troops into immediate combat areas. In fact, we are as advisors. We should do whatever we can, and I think Secretary Kerry is quite skillful at this, to minimize clear differences, important differences, but differences that we don't have to talk about between us and our allies.
But boots on the ground is a difficult thing to wrap our heads around because the Islamic State movement shows up in so many different places.
Quite right. And we do have military missions in many different places. And in fact, we do have advisors on the ground as well as enormous air power in the Mideast region.
What do you make of Japan's involvement in this? Japan found itself sort of a very surprising target of what ISIS was doing.
It's been extremely painful for our Japanese allies. They, I believe, remain true to their rejection of militarism. At the same time, they are in many ways the second largest economy in the world, certainly the third largest, in many ways have a much greater reach than China, which is still going through its industrial revolution. These tragic experiences of people being captured and then highlighted and then being tormented, tortured, and murdered in brutal fashion by ISIS is going to affect them as it affects us and European nations and other nations, including nations in the Mideast, because of Japan's history and their strong rejection of militarism. It's more complicated for them, but it's no less painful for us or for anyone else who suffers this kind of experience. The Japanese seem to be, it seems to be more difficult for them collectively, internally, to deal with this threat than us and the Europeans, and I think we should keep that very much in mind.
If nothing else, ISIS does seem to appreciate the value of propaganda because for as brutal and bloody as the actions they're doing, they get their message out very effectively as well.
Well, sure. We live in the age of the 24/7 news cycle, as you well know better than I do, and pervasive electronic media. It's very easy, therefore, for a small group or even a few individuals to generate global publicity very quickly. And it's important for all of us to keep that in mind. The fact that the U.S. does not pay ransoms, the fact that the British follow this policy, I think, in the long term is wise. And I hope that over time, our friends in Japan and other countries will follow that course. It's, of course, very easy to talk that way when you're sitting in the security of a studio. But I do think it's the more moral and more rational course in dealing with these fanatical groups.
All right. So let's turn our attention now to Europe, where a great deal of attention was paid to the ceasefire that was negotiated by Western European interests along with the Russian leadership and the Ukraine leadership. The ceasefire was signed into effect and really not much seemed to change.
Well, I don't know about that. Russian violations of the ceasefire and aggression by the pro-Moscow volunteers and separatists and their, quote, volunteer, unquote, forces and supporters from Russia. That gets a lot of the news. In other parts of Ukraine, I believe that the fighting levels have declined. We do have considerable economic leverage if Russia brazenly violates the ceasefire. I'm hopeful
that it'll
work. I wrote an op-ed on the subject. I do think it's our best alternative among many bad alternatives.
Our governor here in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, was in London not long ago on a quasi-trade mission, dodging a lot of questions about U.S. policy. But you know, I have a couple of questions about that. One, what difference does it make essentially when a presidential candidate makes an appearance in a place like London? He doesn't have voters there.
Well, no, that's true. It can boomerang very easily if you're critical of the administration from overseas. And I think in Mitt Romney's case in 2012, his tour of Europe and his fundraiser in Israel didn't help him. Obviously, he lost the election, but it didn't help him at the time. There is a tradition of bipartisanship that goes back to the Second World War. FDR quite shrewdly used Wendell Willkie, the Republican he defeated in 1940, who was an internationalist. Nonetheless, the president used him as an emissary. The Truman administration had a major ally in Republican Arthur Vandenberg. From that time, we have established a tradition of trying at least to work together across party lines in diplomacy. It broke down badly during the Vietnam War between the parties and within the Democratic Party. But I think there's an echo of that in politicians like Governor Walker avoiding making waves overseas, and it also permits a politician to play it safe without addressing directly controversial foreign policy matters. It's a very good question. I'm going to think more about this.
Do you think does a trip to London or really anywhere else in the world truly burnish one's foreign policy credentials?
I don't think so. I think it's a good way to get experience. Governor Walker and Chris Christie, who's also been in Britain, and both of them got in some trouble with the media for non-foreign policy reasons. I think it's a good way to learn about foreign countries, and it's a good way to stay visible. Richard Nixon, during his kind of long exile from presidential politics after he was defeated for governor of California in 62 after losing to Kennedy. And then winning in 68, he relentlessly traveled the world and gathered information. At some level, that experience may be informing current politicians, but it also underscores the point it's a very good use of time. It really is if you really want to be president.
Well, Artsir, we appreciate that you have been willing to travel all the way up here from Kenosha. Thank you so much.
It's nice to be here. Glad I made it.
Artsir is professor of political economy and world business and the director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is also our regular foreign policy contributor. Artsir may be a contributor in the realm of foreign policy, but right now we are also in need of contributors of another sort. We are in the midst of our 2015 Winter On Air membership drive, and to keep it on track, we have a goal of $1,100 during this hour of Lake Effect, and you can help make it a success by supporting the interviews you hear about things like foreign policy and recent news, and also arts interviews, music interviews, book interviews, much, much more. Keeping you informed on just what's going on and putting things in context. And you can help make this drive a success by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting wuwm.com/give. Hi, it's Mitch Teich from Lake Effect at Milwaukee Public Radio. As our membership drive continues at WUWM, think about the many ways listening to public radio has changed your life. Well, you are not alone. Even before becoming a voice familiar to most of us, NPR's Tamara Keith was a huge public radio fan. Hi, Tamara.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You're the NPR White House correspondent, but you actually got into public radio in high school as an essayist for Weekend Edition. But before that, you were an NPR listener. What did public radio mean to you growing up?
I started listening to NPR well before I had free will. I think I was in the car seat, in the back seat of the car, like so many NPR listeners. And I grew up initially in Southern California in the LA area, where there is a ton of traffic. And we were in the car all the time, stuck in traffic, listening to our local public radio station. And my parents so loved NPR that, you know how Morning Edition repeats, or All Things Considered repeats, we would listen the second time around and we wouldn't change the channel. And we would talk about the stories and what, how they were put together or what they meant. And it was part of my education. It was part of becoming a worldly person, was listening to NPR. Also, I loved the puzzle on Sunday mornings going to church. We would listen to the puzzle and shout at the radio. It was great.
Did you imagine yourself as potential NPR material?
Oh, not initially, obviously. I guess I probably have. I initially thought I was going to be a volcanologist and study volcanoes when I grew up. I think that at some point I realized that it was a possibility. And then I sent these letters off to NPR personalities asking them about where to go to college if someday I wanted to become an NPR person, and ended up being an essayist. And so, you know, my first day of college, I actually met my now husband the first day of college. And, your first day of college, you're like, oh, what are you going to do when you grow up? And I did say that I wanted to be a correspondent for NPR.
You're at NPR now. Your time in public radio also included stops at a couple of public radio stations in California and one in Ohio. How did those experiences impact what you're doing today?
I think that working at those stations is why I'm able to be an NPR correspondent now. I think that those experiences really shaped me as a journalist. The experiences I got covering local politics and local agriculture and any number of other things. I think being a local member station reporter is the best job in the world, and it makes you, you can do anything. Like, as a member station reporter, as a station reporter, like, I covered everything. And I think that I am more self-sufficient than your average NPR correspondent. I am, like, more technically adept, and all of that is because of my experience at the stations where I worked.
as you look around at the other reporters covering the White House, you are in the position of working for an outlet that probably many of the other reporters are contributing to.
Yes. And would like to work for. That is probably the greatest compliment of all, is you show up in the first week as a White House correspondent and people come up to you and say, you know, I really wanted that job. And they're working for publications that I have huge respect for. So I think that within the media world, people look at NPR and see something that they really admire.
Tamara Keith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
NPR White House correspondent and lifelong public radio listener Tamara Keith. Support the kind of high-caliber reporting you hear each and every day on NPR and on WUWM by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting wuwm.com/give. And thanks so much. The questions on the minds of both providers and consumers when it comes to the next 5 years of healthcare, that's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The Affordable Care Act has been law for a couple of years now, so you might think talking about health policy would be more like a routine checkup by now. But in many ways, it is still like a trip to urgent care. There is the issue of penalties on your taxes for going uninsured, and the issues of what small business owners must provide to their employees or also face penalties. And it is the ongoing questions about the next 5 years in the healthcare arena that underscore the annual Leadership Healthcare Forum, scheduled for next month in Milwaukee. It is organized by UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. Alum Greg Banaschinski is both a leader in the healthcare field in Wisconsin and an organizer of the forum, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Are we at the point where healthcare reform has been law long enough that uncertainty is less a part of the equation than it once was? Are you able to sit down and say, you know, this is likely what you're going to need to be thinking about over the next 5 years?
Oh, Mitch, I wish I could. But you know what? I've been in healthcare now for 35 years, predominantly on the provider side. And the one constant we talk about all the time in healthcare is change. You cannot but pick up a newspaper, a publication, that healthcare in this country is rapidly changing and will continuously change. So no matter what we think is the blueprint in 2015 for healthcare, both on a national level or even on a state or local level, rest assured, if you wait a month, it will change.
Well, and what's significant about this is you say, you know, you've been in this field for 35 years. That well predates the Affordable Care Act, of course.
It predates so many things that have changed in healthcare delivery systems. We didn't have integrated delivery systems like Aurora Healthcare or the networks of hospitals that exist in our state of Wisconsin. Many years ago, we had a collection of independent hospitals and independent physicians practicing in those hospitals, and that world has changed. We didn't have as many of the consolidated health insurers that we have today, national players like Anthem or Humana, United Healthcare. We had Blue Crosses 35 years ago, but the landscape has changed even for the health insurers of this country.
Well, and so it seems like the forum's message is twofold. One is to speak to people in the healthcare industry, but also to speak to consumers. What are the kinds of questions that you hear from both sides of the equation about these next 5 years?
Well, you know, Mitch, this is our third year of doing the healthcare forum through the college. And the theme has been, of course, the continuation of healthcare reform. And in years past, we've had panelists that have represented the healthcare systems. We've had panelists from the state and federal government. We've had moderators that have come from, frankly, the strategy side of where healthcare is potentially leading itself. In And I think what we're trying to do is provide a forum where panelists from different sectors of healthcare can share with the audience what they've seen, some of the tactics that employers are doing, perhaps maybe even getting out of providing the health insurance business and having employees go over to either a private or public exchange, or, you know, giving them some dollar compensation in lieu of health care insurance. We're probably going to hear from some of the panelists that some employers are contemplating banning even further together to purchase health care, maybe even bypassing some of the health insurers and becoming self-insured and aggregating their business, like purchasing groups for maybe like they've done for, you know, raw supplies in the past, that insurance may be just a commodity that is going to be purchased on behalf of their employees. So there's a multitude, I think, of solutions that are being contemplated out there, and we've asked a cross-section of our panelists to speak to what they're seeing unfold in Wisconsin as some of the new solution sets.
Well, and along the lines of solution sets, I know we're speaking to you as a representative of the college and as one who has been organizing this forum, but you also work for a company that is right in the middle of all this. What are the lessons that you have learned as the president of Activate Healthcare Wisconsin that inform how you take these issues on in this format?
Well, a couple things, Mitch. One is we are seeing with increasing number of people having access to healthcare, a critical shortage of primary care nurse practitioners and physicians. Both of our medical colleges, UW and the Medical College of Wisconsin, are actively trying to expand with campuses in Wausau and Green Bay the number of primary care providers. In my backyard here in Jefferson County, it's been announced that they are trying to develop a third medical college in the state of Wisconsin, an osteopathic medicine college, to really have more primary care physicians being trained in Wisconsin. My company is really working with employers to ensure that employees have access to primary care in a timely fashion in a area close proximity to where they work or they live, so that what happens today is many employers, and this has been going on for many years, let's take a play out of an old playbook. In the manufacturing sector back in the 60s and the 70s and 80s in southeastern Wisconsin, many companies had company doctors and nurses on site. This is all coming back again. It's a play that's being replayed again, having employers get back into the provision of health care for their employees, which they did many, many years ago, and then that fell out of favor because of HMOs or large integrated networks. But what we're finding today is employers are saying, you know what, this is probably the second most expensive commodity on my balance sheet next to the cost of employees is health insurance. I better be in this game.
Do you think 5 years from now, are we going to be a healthier place, Wisconsin or the country?
Oh, I do. I have always remained an optimist as far as being in the provision of health care. And been the last 25 years have been in southeastern Wisconsin. So I've seen some huge, great strides as far as the health status of our communities. Patients are living longer. I think the quality of life for them has been extraordinary. I'm blessed that I have a mother who's 93 years old, still living in the house that we grew up in, that is able to function because, frankly, medicine has evolved. And 20, 30 years ago, you wouldn't find that many people living in their 90s. And for you and I and your audience, that's going to be commonplace for us. This longevity of people, the quality of life will expand. What we have to do, though, is help ensure that access to what's changing in healthcare is available for everyone, and that's where we're seeing, not just in southeastern Wisconsin, but, you know, throughout the country, basically lack of access for everyone into the healthcare systems.
Well, very good. Greg Banaschinski, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and best of luck with this year's forum.
Well, thank you. We're excited about it. We think we're going to have a record number of attendees again this year. So every year, Mitch, it just grows on and builds on each other. And we're excited to be able to provide this to the community in southeastern Wisconsin again this year.
Greg Banaschinski is president of Advance Healthcare Wisconsin and one of the organizers of the third annual Leadership Healthcare Forum arranged by UWM's College of Health Sciences on March 11th. You can find out more about the event and registration for it from a link at WUWM.com. WUWM.com is also the place to turn to support us during our 2015 Winter On Air membership campaign. You can call 414-227-3210 as well and become a member or renew your membership. You'll help us reach our goal of $1,100 during this hour of Lake Effect. You'll help keep this program healthy along with the other programs like Fresh Air, like Here and Now, like All Things Considered on the Media, and much, much more. All the things you hear every day and every week on Milwaukee Public Radio. You'll keep it on the air for another year to come. Plus, you will be entered to win an amazing collection of gift certificates to 34 of Milwaukee's best restaurants, plus a microbrewery tour and a private pizza dinner with wine. It's all valued at over $2,000. The certificates are valued between $50 and $100 each. Dining around Milwaukee has really never been this much fun, and the destinations have been handpicked by our very own Lake Effect culinary contributor Kyle Cherik, and they include a variety of restaurants ranging from All Purpose to Le Rev to the North Shore Boulangerie to Pizza Man. They're all just amazing places, and maybe you've had a chance to visit them and you'd like to go back, or maybe you've never been to these places, and this would be a great opportunity. You'll be entered to win those 34 gift certificates valued at over $2,000 in total when you make a contribution during this on-air membership drive by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting WUWM.com/gift. You can see the complete list of restaurants at that website as well. You give today and you're automatically entered into that drawing. Contributions, though, are not required. They are, in fact, certainly appreciated. Ukraine has been in the news quite a bit lately, but not necessarily for its music. Fortunately, the band Scythian is able to remedy that situation with their blend of Ukrainian and Celtic traditions. We'll hear a sample when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. But first, hi, it's Mitch Tyke from Lake Effect at Milwaukee Public Radio. As our membership drive continues at WUWM, think about the many ways listening to public radio has changed your life. Well, you are not alone. Maz Jobrani was an Iranian-American comedian living in California when he got a fateful phone call asking if he would be interested in appearing on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Maz Jobrani picks up the story from there.
So Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is an interesting one. I used to play soccer on Saturdays before I hurt my Achilles heel. But I would listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the way home always. And I remember hearing Sarah Silverman as the call-in guest one time. And I thought, oh, that would be cool to do this. And so one day, I don't know how it happened, but my agents called and they said, hey, do you want to be a call-in guest for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, of course. And they didn't know that I'd wanted to. But I think that what had happened was Wait, Wait was looking to add some new panelists, and I think they were looking at comedians. And so then they had me as a call-in guest the first time, and that was fun. And then they go, hey, they want to see if you want to do it. I go, of course I want to do it. And then the first time I did it, I was so excited about it. I was actually on a vacation in Hawaii with my wife and my son, who was 2.5 at the time. And we were there with some friends, and the plan had been we were going to go there and stay with our friends for a few days and then fly back. Landed at LAX at like 6 in the morning. I was going to drive, you know, have my wife take the kid and go home, and I was going to get on another plane and keep going. And we're in Hawaii having a great time, and my friend says, dude, where are you going? Like, you could stay. We have this place for another few days. Just stay. And I go, no, I'm doing Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he's like, yeah, but can't you just do it another time? I go, you don't get it. This is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I was so excited. I blew off an extended stay in Hawaii, so I could go do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Well, hey, this is pledge drive season here, so that is a positively perfect story to have you tell to remind people why it's important to support their local public radio station.
Absolutely, man. I gave up Hawaii. You guys can give up $5 a month or $10 or whatever.
Maz Jobrani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Appreciate it.
Maz Jobrani is right. If he can cut short his Hawaiian vacation, making a two-minute call to support WUWM does not seem like such a burden. Call us now at 414-227-3210 or visit us online at wuwm.com/give. And thanks so much.
Tale of a strange dark night as I walked in the fields of St. James. It was midnight when the heavens fell, hurling down a comet of flame.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier in the show, we spoke with our foreign policy contributor about the continuing violence and unrest in Ukraine. There is plenty of unrest and a little bit of Ukraine in the music of the band Scythian, which takes its name from Ukrainian nomads. It is energetic music, which takes in sounds from Celtic dervish fiddling and a more mainstream rock tradition as well. It all adds up to a sound the members call immigrant rock, and it'll be in the spotlight this week in Milwaukee as the band plays a show at Turner Hall Ballroom. That's on Thursday night. Ahead of that show, Dan Federica, one of three Federicas in the group, joined Bonnie North by phone and offered a preview of Scythian's upcoming tour and its upcoming new album.
Yeah, we're going to be releasing a new album called Old Tin Can. So it's the Old Tin Can Tour. It's due to come out in April, but actually this is going to be a pre-release tour, so anyone who comes to any of our shows can get their first shot at the album.
Very nice. And I'm assuming it's in your wheelhouse. I mean, Scythian has this amazing mix. It's sort of a Celtic fusion and Ukrainian and gypsy and klezmer and all kinds of things all mixed up. And a lot of Nashville, too.
Yeah, it's kind of a smorgasbord there. You know, we do play bluegrass festivals. We can cross over because our playlist is so eclectic. But one thing that we try to kind of zero in on is, like, what is it from each culture that gets people up and dancing and having a good time? So all the music kind of does seem together very well because it has the same spirit, which is you work all week, let it all go, and have the time of your life tonight. So that's our goal.
Well, if anyone listening has seen you in concert, you know that you take that to heart on stage, too, because I have never seen so many acrobatics with instruments.
Dad had seen that. He would have been mortified if we'd done that as kids, but I think definitely a few chips in our instruments.
That's certainly part of the Celtic tradition is the dance. I mean, so many, that's what people played for, is they played for dances. Is that true in the Ukrainian tradition, too? Because that's where you and your brother come from.
Yes, definitely. And actually, that's why we were drawn to the Celtic tradition in the first place, is because there were so many similarities where, you know, Ukrainians were always down on their luck, always had someone ruling over them. And they just found ways of keeping their cultures and tradition alive. And dance was a huge element. There was dance, you know, couple dancing, but there's also just individual dancing. And so for us, when we saw the Irish tradition, we're like, oh my gosh, that's just like ours. And so we really gravitated right away to the Celtic tradition.
Now, but you both grew up in classical traditions, right? You both played classical music first?
Yes, that's correct. My mom, she taught us how to play. I grew up playing classical piano, and my brother was a violinist. We kind of got a little bit burned out on the classical and quit, you know, to play sports in college. And then afterwards, we got the itch again, but we decided just to kind of do our own thing, and we got into folk music. And it really was the Celtic fiddling that reawakened that desire in us. And my brother went to Ireland, spent 4 months playing in the streets. So at night, he would go to the Irish pub, learn the tunes, and then spend the whole next day playing the tunes he'd learned the night before. And then when he came back, he had this vast repertoire, but just awesome, killer jigs and reels. And that became the backbone.
Tell her that a waste of time in me, that now she knows when I resemble her to thee. Sweet and fair she seems to be. Small is the worth of beauty from the light retired, but her go forth and suffer herself to be desired, and not blush or to be admired. So to be admired. Go. Rose, tell her that a waste of time in me, that now she knows
smooth and clear she seems to be.
So how do you integrate the other stuff that you do, the Ukrainian tunes, gypsy tunes, klezmer tunes? How does a Scythian arrangement come to be?
I guess it comes from, like, somewhere deep. We don't really just sit down. Someone has an idea. And so this is the general structure of the song. And then everyone just starts adding what comes to their mind. And, you know, I did grow up in the Shenandoah Valley, so there was a lot of bluegrass around. And then, you know, grew up on Ukrainian music, classical music. So that's all part of me, and we each have our own various backgrounds. And so it's really interesting to see what people say, oh, this will fit. And one neat thing about Celtic music is it does fit very well with, like, different cultures. Like, there's the African 6-8 time that it fits well with. So you can put in a Latin groove, African groove. And so it does meld very well with other genres. But then every once in a while we decided, well, let's just switch. And, like, you know, the new album, Old Tin Can, we actually have a song in Ukrainian. So we try and actually, you know, make it a cultural experience too, where my brother and I, Ukrainian was our first language. So we decided, you know, we asked people, hey, would you want to hear one of our songs? People are so receptive. Even at an Irish festival, there's two dudes singing in Ukrainian. But I think it really does key into the spirit. And Old Tin Can, it's basically a companion album. We just released an album, Jump at the Sun, and it was founded entirely by our fans. But they were so generous, they overgave. So as a thank you, we came up with this album, and it's basically our tip of the hat to all the different traditions that inspired us. So it's basically like the root of the tree that is Scythian. So you'll hear songs that are like bluegrass or Doc Watson tunes or the Carter family, and then Irish ones, you know, and songs in Ukrainian. So this new album, Old Tin Can, is basically kind of a good snapshot of everything that goes into a Scythian set list.
Except for that live exuberance. I mean, it comes across on all of your recordings, how much fun you're having and how much you love to play. But there is something about seeing you guys live that is that extra bit that is kind of the complete package. It makes the whole Scythian experience something because, again, it's just this. You guys must be just wrung out at the end.
Oh, I mean, it's more like we're just the adrenaline is so pumping through is so hard that it's. It takes us hours to fall asleep at night because the crowd is the big X factor. Every, you know, we do the same or similar shows every night, but it's the crowd that is different every time. And so how we interact with the crowd, like we give out some energy, and if they give it back, we give more. And so every night it's unscripted. So it's really fun to experience basically people coming together. And that's what we love about our shows is the crowd is always a huge part of every show.
It is the live experience then.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
and so people they love our music, and they've often said that is like, I wish there was a way of canning the energy, and we do our best on the album to convey that, but it's kind of like just two different styles of art. Like when you get the album, this is our music, this is our art, and then when you come to the live show, it's like that music pumped up with like 10 cans of Red Bull.
They're dancing from the sunlight, our music from the trees, our manners from the ocean, and our schooling from the breeze. Every lassie is a princess, every laddie born a king. Forever by the fireside, you'll hear their tinker sing. La la la, I'm as free as I can be. I'm a tinker and a traveler, you'll never burden me. That's fun, the Judas Iscariot, forever on the run. If you think that you can chain us, you might as well jump in the sun.
find that with everything that's going on in Ukraine right now, that people are even more receptive to hearing the music and hearing about the Ukrainian culture?
Definitely. And it's been really awesome, just kind of like people reaching out. My brother and myself are, you know, our supporters. They're like, I'm so sorry about what's going on. What do you think? And, you know, it's been interesting. Everyone's always really keyed in that we were Ukrainian or different. But now you can just see how many people really do care about what's going on there. And I've definitely have felt, you know, much more, you know, sympathy and attention about what's going on. And so I'm just thankful that people are aware and it's getting out. Not everything is getting out. My dad was just over there recently. But it's definitely a tough situation. And I realize now, it makes me realize that the fact that we can have a show like at Turner Hall and just let our hair down and have a good time, I'm thankful. I mean, we're lucky that we can do that because over there, it's just crazy. I have, first world problems. Like, you know, where am I going to go tonight to enjoy myself? And then when you look at the grand scheme of things, how lucky we are to have this and to be celebrating music as it was intended. I mean, like these wars and all that is, you know, it was more meant to be like what we're going to be experiencing Thursday night. It's like people coming together as opposed to being torn apart. So, you know, having the whole situation in Ukraine, it really does cast light on how fortunate we are, you know, to have what we have.
Now, after this tour goes over, are you guys coming back to Irish Fest this year?
Yeah, we are indeed. It's going to be a great show. We have some surprises planned.
You do? Okay.
Yes.
I'll have to swing by. I always swing by when you're there, but I will definitely have to stop by and see what you do. But I'm assuming at that point you'll be playing from the new album, but also some of your back catalog as well.
Definitely. And, Jump at the Sun was the prior release, but that was just last year. It was not even a year ago and that we released it. So we're still pushing that hard. And but with the Old Tin Can, it's more of like a stripped down album. So there'll be elements of every set where we're going to have like an Old Tin Can part of every set now, where we, you know, kind of strip it down for a few songs and then bring it back up. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be kind of a new look for Scythian this year. So we're excited.
All right. Well, so am I. I'm looking forward to both here at Turner Hall in the next couple of days, and then also later this summer at Irish Fest. And Dan, I want to say thanks so much for taking time to talk with us this morning, and best of luck with the tour.
Well, thank you very much, and hope to see you on the 26th.
As I walked down the Broadway one evening last July, I met a maid who was betrayed, a sailor Johnson's eye. To Tiffany's I took her, I didn't mind expense. I bought her two gold earrings, they cost me 15 cents.
Dan Federica plays rhythm guitar with the band Scythian, which will play a show this Thursday evening at Turner Hall Ballroom. It's a show in support of their new album, which officially isn't released for a while, but will be available at the concert. Dan Federica spoke with Bonnie North. And that interview with Dan Federica is just another example of the great arts and music coverage we bring you really all the time on Lake Effect. There's that interview we heard from Barry Manilow, who's coming to Milwaukee soon on this program last week. We also bring you interviews with authors who are coming to town and interviews with artists and curators of art exhibits that are on display here. They're really interviews that you don't get a chance to hear pretty much anywhere else on the radio dial. And when you call 414-227-3210 or you go online to wuwm.com/give and you become a member or you renew your membership in WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, you are supporting the kinds of interviews that you hear every day. Interviews with bands, interviews with authors, interviews with newsmakers and analysts that help you make sense of the things that are going on in the world around you. I hope you'll call 414-227-3210 or go to wuwm.com/give. You can even become a sustaining member. Maybe you can give at the $5 a month level or the $10 a month level or even the $20 or $25 a month level. They are all important contributions that help keep this show healthy and all the programs you hear on this public radio station healthy as well. When you make that contribution right now, you're also entered to win an amazing collection of gift certificates to 34 of Milwaukee's best restaurants valued at over $2,000. The certificates are valued between $50 and $100 and all hand-selected by our culinary contributor Kyle Cherick. That's when you call right now, 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. One last break, and then the work of the Sojourner Family Peace Center is the focus of the latest installment in our series, Precious Lives. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's time now for the latest installment in our series on children and gun violence in Milwaukee, Precious Lives.
This is the story about...
I want to do it, too.
Okay.
One, two.
This is Precious Lives.
Stories about kids.
Teens.
Guns.
Guns.
Yeah, we end the violence.
Bye-bye.
Because we are precious.
I'm Eric Vaughn. This is Precious Lives. The lot at 6 and Walnut usually looks like your typical construction site. But today, adjacent to mounds of dirt, there's a white tent, hundreds of people in business casual attire, and a string quartet. Everyone is celebrating the groundbreaking of a new building. A 78,000 square foot space that will accommodate the largest family justice center in the country.
Nobody's done what you're doing.
That's Casey Gwynn. He started the Family Justice Center movement back in 1989 in San Diego. What's a family justice center? Usually, a woman dealing with domestic violence has to travel all over the city to get help. One location for a restraining order, another for counseling. Family justice centers aim to solve this problem by putting everything she needs under one roof.
When this center opens, it will be the largest, most comprehensive multi-agency model in America. So congratulations.
But how exactly will these superlatives make a difference for families in Milwaukee? And might the new center reduce the likelihood that a kid will pick up a gun?
Kent Laverne thinks so.
That's Precious Lives producer Emily Foreman.
Kent is one of the new center's main champions. He's chief deputy district attorney for Milwaukee County.
When I was prosecuting firearms cases, we're prosecuting mostly younger offenders, age 17 to 21, for felony offenses for possessing a gun.
He's been prosecuting firearms and domestic violence-related cases in Milwaukee for almost 17 years.
That not only did they have a felony conviction, but almost every one of these young men also had a history of being an abused or neglected child.
And he split my chin with a 12-gauge gun.
That's Hannah. Hannah isn't her real name, but that's the name she asked me to use. She's been staying at the Sojourner Family Peace Center, Milwaukee's largest domestic violence shelter, on and off for the past 4 years. Hannah met her abuser, we'll call him Jim, a few months after he got out of prison. From ages 16 to 18, Jim served time for unlawful possession of a firearm.
The reason why he does that is because the way he was brought up, too.
She doesn't completely blame Jim for how he treated her.
He couldn't be a child like he wanted to.
Children who grow up in households afflicted by domestic violence, the boys often drop out of school, pick up a gun, and join a gang because they're looking for solidarity.
Hannah says Jim's mom didn't really look after him, and he watched the men that his mom dated beat her.
At 9 years old, he was carrying, he had a 12-gauge, you know, and he's keeping it in the garbage can.
That was around the time the mafia insane Vice Lords, a Chicago-based gang, lured in Jim with the promise of solidarity.
Yeah, he saw people get killed right in front of him.
Every time a new felony hits his desk, Kent asks himself,
and how can we better respond to that as a community at an earlier stage in the life cycle of that family before those gunshots get exchanged out on our streets or on our playgrounds or in our parks?
He thinks the new center is the answer, a way for families to break this cycle of violence. Carmen Petrie knows firsthand how hard it is to bounce back from domestic violence. She's the executive director of Sojourner Family Peace Center. She's also a survivor.
I grew up in a violent home. So my passion around this work started at an early age. My mother was an abused woman. She was married when she was very young to my father, who was 18, who beat her for years. I remember the chaos and the unpredictability and the fear, you know, when people are fighting around you.
Then next thing you know, I hear a knock at the door. So I'm like, who is it?
Jim demanded that she open the door.
I instantly knew the voice. My heart just started beating fast. I'm asking him to leave. Please just leave. So I hear the gun cock. I'm going to shoot down the door. I'm going to kill everybody.
Hannah has two small children under the age of 3. One girl, one boy.
I'm like, please, I'm pleading. He's like, I got 7 shots. I'm willing to go all the way.
The cops came just in time.
Today, if you're abused or your child is abused, you might have to go to 3, 4, 5 different locations to you know, to get your needs.
First thing I had to do was call the police, get the restraining order. Second,
you might have to go to counseling. Your child may need counseling. Your child may need a forensic exam. You may need to speak to the district attorney's office.
If she needs the police will be there. If she needs the DA's office, we will be there to visit her in the center.
One of the hardest parts is being out in public.
I was afraid. I was isolated. When I say I stayed in all day, every day.
That ringing is the front door at the Sojourner Truth House shelter.
I was scared to get on the bus. I mean, all I did was stay in the house.
With the new center, women don't have to make a choice between getting help and safety.
For the people that's scared, that's actually scared of their abuser, everything is right there.
The centralized approach means victims don't have to recount their painful experience to multiple providers. And it will make getting help for kids, breaking that cycle of violence, much easier.
If she needs the services from Children's Hospital to provide therapy to her kids, it'll be right there on site.
The center will open near the end of 2015, so it will be a couple of years before we see the results. As for Hannah, she can't know how the abuse she endured will impact her kids or if the cycle will stop with her. But she's getting help and hopes her family is ready to move on.
Actually, I'm moving out today. I have me a place and everything. Yes, me and the kids, so we doing our outtake today.
Sojourner Family Peace Center needs volunteers to answer the 24-hour domestic violence hotline or work with kids. You can check out a link to all of Sojourner's volunteer opportunities on our website, preciouslivesproject.org. Precious Lives is produced by 371 Productions in association with WUWM, WNOV, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're supported by the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and the Isabel and Alfred Bader Fund. Music by Kiran V of Fresh Cut Collective.
You can find links and listen to all the installments in our weekly Precious Lives series at WUWM.com. That is Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow on the show, how cuts to the UW system could have an outsized impact on research going on at UW-Milwaukee, plus the end of an era for a Milwaukee store serving the area's art community. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Thanks so much for your support of Lake Effect today and throughout the course of time. You can become a member of WUWM or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio by calling right now 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. And fresh air comes your way next.